This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Hey, everybody, it's Jessica, and I'm about to bring you an episode with Jonathan Alter. He is an award-winning author, political analyst, documentary filmmaker, columnist, television producer, and radio host. We talked about a lot of things related to Trump and not related to Trump. We were able to touch on his most recent book, which is called His Very Best, Jimmy Carter, A Life. We were also able to talk a little bit about his earlier books, which include three New York Times bestsellers, The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies, also The Promise, President Obama Year One, and finally, The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. I hope you enjoy this conversation. We were able to talk for a long time and we edited it down for your convenience. As always, please rate, review, and subscribe. So again, thank you so much for being here. And you've written three New York Times books. You have written really exhaustive and compelling biographies about Jimmy Carter, FDR, President Obama, two books on President Obama. And I was thinking about specific questions that I had about each of those presidents. But the thing that kept just reverberating in my mind was, how are we the same country that elected those three men and then elected former President Trump? And in my view, may elect him once again. I know this is a terribly biased question, but what has happened to us?
Well, I don't think it's biased. First of all, thanks for having me on. Second of all, I don't think it's biased to defend democracy. So, you know, I think this is true of the press in general, podcasts, everybody. Like, it's all hands on deck. It's silly to have, you know, to go to our doom with phony balance. It's just, it's insane. And it's a potential problem. So we all have to do what we can to make sure that Biden is reelected for all of his shortcomings. And I spent a good chunk of 2023 urging him, pleading with him not to run for reelection. And I wrote in the New York Times and other places. But this is, you know, the hand that we've been dealt. And so we now need to do everything we can to help him over the finish line. But, you know, the answer to your question is, it's a country that can both elect Barack Obama and Donald Trump. And in some way, Trump was a reaction to Obama, that the changing face of America, which Obama symbolized quite literally, was very threatening to a lot of people. That doesn't mean that everybody who voted for Trump was a racist. A lot of them voted for Obama. But people are uncomfortable. Many people are uncomfortable with the pace of change, and they're vulnerable to demagoguery when they are thinking through their fears and their anxieties rather than their hopes. And, you know, we've seen this a lot before in American history. We've just never seen it at the presidential level. So the only thing that's different is that Trump got to the presidency. I mean, I was just listening to a podcast that Ezra Klein has, and he had a guest on who's written a book that has a lot about David Duke and Pat Buchanan. And I know Pat Buchanan quite well, actually. I don't know David Duke, but I was reminded that when David Duke ran for governor of Louisiana, and this is a guy who had been literally a wizard in the Ku Klux Klan, a Nazi, he got 55% of the white vote in the early 1990s. He lost the election because of the black turnout, and because, you know, 45% of whites, you know, had come to their senses. But we've seen this. We saw it under Joe McCarthy. We saw it in Italy with Mussolini and Berlusconi, who has a lot in common with Trump. And so there's always this danger. It's just a question of having the circumstances that allows it to reach all the way to the presidency. I mean, in the 1930s, I was writing about Franklin Roosevelt. It wasn't a biography, but I was writing about him in the early 1930s. And, you know, he was challenged by Huey Long, who was a populist demagogue, more from the left than the right, but demagogue nonetheless, who might have become president, but he was assassinated in 1935. You know, Pat Buchanan didn't make it, but he threw a real scare into George H.W. Bush in 1992 and, you know, got a lot of votes that year in the Republican primaries. So this has always been part of American political life. We just have been fortunate enough to avoid it at the presidential level until now.
It's interesting. As you were talking, I was thinking about how I spent a lot of time wondering about the guardrails that did and didn't hold once President Trump entered the office. But it seems to me that when you were saying, you know, we haven't had this happen before with respect to a president, of course, we have so much of our government and so much of our lives are reactions to whatever happened before. I spend a lot of time thinking about the Supreme Court. So many of the cases are reactions to what happened before. But do you feel that leading up to the election, there was something different about the 2016 election where the structural guideposts that are supposed to be in place that make sure that Pat Buchanan and David Duke don't become the nominee? Did something happen to those that allowed Trump to become the nominee and ultimately the victor?
Yeah, the Republican Party had been rotting for some years. And so when he staged a hostile takeover of the party, in some ways it was like pushing on an open door because, you know, they had been discredited by George W. Bush in a lot of ways. You know, a terrible, stupid war, as Obama correctly pointed out, and the greatest recession slash almost depression since the 1930s. And so the old ruling establishment in the Republican Party was really played out and primed for the plucking. So when those other feckless candidates, you know, mounted their campaigns in 2016, it wasn't that hard for Trump to win. I mean, his biggest challenger was Ted Cruz, who is despised by everybody. All of his colleagues, Republicans and Democrats, think he's a complete asshole and always has been. And he's, you know, Trump is a major league asshole also, but Ted Cruz is a charmless asshole. So that's kind of who he was up against. I mean, I thought that maybe John Kasich had a chance of winning the nomination. I remember interviewing him in New Hampshire, but he wasn't hardcore enough for the base. And the Republican base, which had been very radical since 1964 when they nominated Barry Goldwater, was just very strong. And it turned out, I mean, there were a number of surprises, Jessica, along the way, because it turned out that the base didn't really give a shit about any issues. They just liked the fuck you politics, you know, and they didn't really, it turned out that they didn't really care that A, Trump wasn't religious at all. B, he had given to Democrats and pretty clearly had been pro-choice just a few years ago, very likely paid for abortions. It's just amazing still that shortly before the election, when the Access Hollywood tape comes out and, you know, it sends him reeling for a few days. And then all of, you know, the Republicans just rationalized it and they swept it right away. And, you know, he said the most awful things and he confessed to having said them. And they bought his, you know, locker room talk line about it. And so everything they claimed they cared about was subordinate to their desire to fuck the Democrats and get power. It was about owning libs and amassing power. And in that sense, it was the face of the modern Republican Party is very ugly. And it's not a surprise that, you know, such long-term Republicans as, you know, George Will and Bill Kristol are long since out of that party.
Well, and I think they must feel like they have no home. And as you're talking, I'm thinking of another question that I get asked a lot. I am not a historian and journalist. I think you would have a much better perspective on this, which is the Democratic Party similarly susceptible in the sense of if the Democrats had a weak slate running for the nomination, could the Democrats similarly be taken over by somebody who, in my view, doesn't really respect the rule of law, isn't really particularly interested in any issue other than obtaining power? And is there something in your view that is just qualitatively, structurally different? Is it a different paradigm when we're talking about the Democratic Party?
So let me answer that question by saying that Democratic Party could be taken over by somebody on the far left. I don't think that person could ultimately be elected. Like, I think you could see the nomination of an AOC for president, and she's very talented politician, but she's too far left for what's basically a center-right country. And so I don't think that she could be elected. I don't think Sanders would have been elected. But in terms of the larger question, no, I don't really think so. I don't think the Democratic Party has a problem right now with respect for the rule of law. It has a number of other challenges. It has a left wing that is not only sometimes really politically stupid, but has substituted identity politics for a broader sense of the public good. And identity politics is different than the old coalition politics. It's not where you bring ethnic groups together for the purposes of winning elections, which is what Roosevelt and other Democrats of the 20th century did, and Obama did that. It's where people's, true core identity is connected to their race, their gender, and they have a little bit of trouble seeing beyond that, and they get extremely intolerant. So they want diversity of everything except viewpoint. And they're very, very narrow-minded. I'm talking about certain Democrats on the left, on the far left. They're very, very narrow-minded when it comes to having a bigger tent. But there's some very encouraging news on this. You know, we read all this negative stuff about Biden, and a lot of it is important to absorb. But he's done a very good job of unifying the Democratic Party. And we don't really have those problems in this cycle. And the Democratic Party is quite unified. I mean, a depressing number of Democrats, they've written Biden off. They think he's too old. And it'll be interesting to see whether they show up or not. The Democrats' totals among Blacks and Latinos is slipping, but it's still, overwhelmingly Democratic. But there's been very little squabbling inside the Democratic Party. And in that sense, it's a little bit of a repudiation of the great humorist Will Rogers line in the 1930s, which was, I'm a member of no organized political party. I'm a Democrat. And fortunately, Democrats are, at least for right now, they're getting past that. But I don't think there's a problem with guardrails and the Democrats. What we do have a problem with is that we've got people like Elon Musk who are actually taking seriously that there's a Democratic plot to bring millions of immigrants in and have them vote Democratic. And that this is, if you listen to the protesters in Charlottesville, Jews will not replace us. That means Jews will not engineer this sinister plot that Elon Musk believes of bringing in all these migrants. So, you know, Democrats are not in the position of threatening the Constitution. They are, however, in the position of a feckless and inadequate and, I pray, not unsuccessful effort to defend the Constitution, which is what all of them, when they take office, pledge to do with their hand on a Bible.
This isn't the next question I planned, but I think the listeners will be asking, what do we do about a group who believes Elon Musk? What do we do about groups that believe all of this disinformation and misinformation that is floating throughout our information ecosystem? In the sense of, I think that most people are well-intentioned, and if you are fed a diet of lies about a candidate or a political party or an outside organization, you thought a lot about voter behavior and about what makes a good leader. I mean, how can we reach people to say, I'm sorry, but that's simply not the case?
Well, I mean, first of all, there's no point in trying to convert the Trump base. So people go, well, the Trump people won't ever change. That's true, but that's only about 35%, right? So the basic answer to your question is to stop wringing our hands and start ringing doorbells. And if you live in a state where it's already all blue or all red, you can ring doorbells now on the phone. They have these call tools that allow you to call in to other states. And mostly when you do that, you'll be calling Democrats or independents who, if you get in a conversation with them about this, if they say, I read that, X, Y, or Z conspiracy theory, some of the time, if somebody's susceptible to believing that, there's nothing you can do. But other times, they are not beyond reaching, and their phones don't ring that much. They don't have a lot of communication. They're in this, you know, they're doom scrolling. They're in this silo. And if somebody on the phone, even if they don't live in their state, and they never know that you don't live in their state, you know, or rarely know, talks to them, has a conversation, that's the most effective form of voter persuasion, is at the doorstep. Second most effective is on the phone. And television ads and digital ads and everything else comes well below that human contact. So, you know, Biden's best bet is if he matches the million volunteers that Barack Obama had in 2008. And if he really has, you know, a real strong get out the vote campaign, a really strong ground game, he can overcome a lot of these challenges that he's having in the polls. If people are depressed and their depression is manifest as crippling despair, then Trump's the next president. It's not that complicated. It's just about whether people will recognize that you don't really have a choice about when democracy is calling you to defend it. When history's calling, you have to answer the call, or you have to explain to your grandchildren why you didn't answer the call. So everybody has to figure out like what they can do. As a journalist, all I can do is yak on TV and write and try to convince people, or do what I'm doing today, you know, or figure out ways to try to hurt Robert F. Kennedy's chances, Jr.'s chances, so that he doesn't spoil the election for Biden, or, you know, whatever is necessary, whatever one can do. And for most people, unless they, you know, can give a lot of money to a super PAC or something, it's going to be in the form of elbow grease, just working.
And it's such an important point about the down ballot races. And we tend to focus so much just on the top of the ticket, but there are really energizing candidates for governor, for senator, even for state legislature who can get people to the polls. And once they're there, they're going to spend time on the whole ballot. And as you were answering, I was thinking about your book about Jimmy Carter, His Very Best Life. And I was thinking about that you had asked Joe Biden not to run again. And that in thinking about Jimmy Carter, again, his very best Jimmy Carter alive, it sounded to me like much of his success was also his undoing. And I'm wondering if you see that in Joe Biden as well.
Well, in Jimmy Carter's case, I make the point that he was elected by Watergate because he was this obscure former governor of Georgia coming from the outside in 1976 when people were really tired of Washington. It was just 2 years after Nixon resigned and kind of rode in on this wave. He said, "I'll never lie to you." And it was a contrast to Nixon. But then when he gets there, the press treats him as if he's another Nixon. You know, there was so much distrust of the president at that point that in some ways he, you know, as his press secretary said, he not only didn't get a honeymoon, he didn't get a one-night stand. Media. And he made a number of mistakes, but he also had a series of real accomplishments that are completely undervalued and that most people have completely forgotten about, but that, you know, helped make the United States a better country. And the conventional wisdom on him that he was a mediocre president and a great former president, I flip a little bit. I think he was an underrated American president. He doesn't belong on Mount Rushmore, but he was seriously underrated and a slightly overrated former president because former presidents don't really have very much power. And he did, you know, a lot to eradicate guinea worm disease and he supervised elections. And I could go over his other significant accomplishments as a former president, but they pale by comparison to, you know, for instance, the 14 major pieces of environmental legislation that he signed when he was president and a lot of other things that we could talk about on the, particularly internationally. But I think he was undermined by circumstances that were largely beyond his control. You know, inflation, which was way worse than what we have now. Ridiculously high interest rates. They went as high as 19%. It's really hard to get reelected if I think at the time of the election, they were 15%. You have 15% interest rates, double digit inflation, unemployment that's at 7 or 8%. So, you know, the objective conditions were so much worse than what Biden faces. Some of the sourness of the national mood is quite similar. You know, Americans are not in a position to credit anybody's accomplishments. So when Carter tried to talk about all the things that he had gotten done, nobody much cared by that point, in part because of the economy. So, I mean, I wrote in the Washington Post, you know, a comparison between Carter and Biden a couple of years ago. And there are some comparisons and Biden connected to Carter. He was the first senator to endorse Jimmy Carter. And then even though he was very close to Ted Kennedy, he stayed loyal to him when Kennedy challenged him. Now, Carter didn't have the problem of being old, but Biden doesn't have the problem of being challenged in his own party the way Ted Kennedy did. That was very, very damaging to Carter's chances in 1980. And Biden has so much of a better economy. But having said that, you know, Trump has some of this outsider, anti-institutional momentum that Carter himself had in 1976. And people tend to like outsiders. And they, you know, and even though Trump has already been president, he's seen as the outsider. You know, when there was that story in New York where Biden holds this fundraiser with Clinton, Obama, and Stephen Colbert, and Trump is alone going to an event for a police officer who was killed. And, you know, the New York Times is contrasting this as if this is favorable to Biden, that he's got the support of the former presidents and, you know, and Mitt Romney and George W. Bush and won't come within a million miles of Trump, as if that's like a bad thing for Trump. Their support for Trump wouldn't help him. I mean, I think the only sort of criticism of him that would really hurt, and I hope we're going to see this, is of his own people. Only fewer than 10% of his former cabinet members have endorsed him. Most of them think he's a menace. But, you know, his former defense secretary, former chief of staff, and former national security advisor all say he's a danger to our country. And so, I think this election will hinge a little bit on whether people like that can be persuasive. But, you know, in terms of him having like the party machinery, you know, he controls all the party machinery now. And the fact that he doesn't have the old Republican Party couldn't be less relevant for him at this point. Let me just amend what I just said, because a lot of this race is going to be determined by Republican women in the suburbs who large numbers of them voted for Biden the last time. If they trend back to Trump, and you know, there's some polls that show that they are, that's why Trump is doing, you know, pretty well, is that these independents are in these polls anyway, are breaking for him. They need to be clawed away. And I guess I would argue that George W. Bush and Mitt Romney should get involved in the campaign in order to get those folks who voted for Bush and Romney.
That's really interesting to highlight that group. You know, of course, and it's such a cliche, it's going to be the swing voters in the swing states. There's a reason that you mentioned Georgia. There's a reason that you mentioned Arizona. That's the system we've created in this country. I would love to spend a lot more time talking about the election with you, but I know that we only have a few more minutes, and I know you're going to be covering the first criminal case ever brought against a former president of the United States, the New York hush money case. And I wanted to briefly, as we end, ask you about that New York case and the first case that I think the case we expected to go first, which is the DC election interference case. Of course, we know that case actually is on hold, in my view, for two different Supreme Court questions. The New York hush money case, I think for a lot of people, this feels like legally the most tenuous case against the former president. I think for some people, it feels like, well, it's just bookkeeping. What's the big deal? And of course, we're talking about Trump's efforts to pay off Stormy Daniels right before the election so that she did not share her story of allegedly having an affair with the former president, and that there were problems with his payment, that it went through first Michael Cohen, that the former president repaid Michael Cohen, but it was cast as a legal payment when allegedly it was not, and that this was done in furtherance of concealing or committing another crime. And that's why we are able to bump this case up from a misdemeanor to a felony. And so with that very brief background, I'm wondering what you're looking for in this case, and if you think this could make a difference with the electorate, depending on what happens in the courtroom.
Well, on the second question, I don't know the answer to it, and I have given up trying to predict what makes a difference. I'm not in agreement with those people who think they know the answer to that question. Oh, nobody will care about this. Well, that could be right, but if he's convicted around the 1st of June, which I expect, you could also have people who go, you know, I trust juries. And they've rendered a judgment on this is different than an indictment. He's been found guilty by a jury of his peers. And we don't want a felon as president, you know. And so I think there's a certain number of people who could react that way. I'm not saying they will react that way, but they could. And we need to keep that in mind. And there were some indication in exit polls people felt that way. Now, obviously, it would have been better if it was the Jack Smith, what I call the Trump coup trial, which I'm also credentialed to cover if it ever goes to trial before the election, which is looking less and less likely. But the hush money trial will do. And it is not just a bookkeeping matter. The Manhattan DA brings many falsification of business documents, which is what these 34 counts cover, brings many of those cases to trial every year. And he often bumps them up to felonies. If you don't prosecute fraud and fraudulent business practices, then you have no deterrent, no way to prevent people from doing this. And I really don't like it when people minimize law breaking. He was pretending that this $130,000 was a legal retainer for Michael Cohen. And it was not. It was to pay Stormy Daniels. And was it in furtherance of a crime? Yes. Interference with a presidential election. That's a pretty big crime. Now, you know, I know that, you know, there's a view that this is a novel interpretation of the law. Interestingly, in one of the pretrial motions, the DA said they wanted to suppress the argument that it was a novel defense. And that motion, almost all of the motions from the prosecution was granted. Almost all of Trump's motions were denied. He would say it was because the judge is biased. But if you actually read the reasoning, the denial of their motions is very, very strong legally. You know, this trial is set up in such a way, and this is often the case with trials, by the pretrial motions that I think a conviction is, it's not a sure thing, but it's quite likely.
Well, and as you mentioned in Old Goats, those rulings, I think, are likely to be upheld on appeal. So we know the scope, I would say, generally speaking, we know the scope of that trial. We know what the trial will cover. And I know that you said you think increasingly it's likely that the I actually call them the three election interference cases, in the sense that the hush money payments, I think for the reasons that you said, that case was about interfering with the election, but it was a different election. It was the 2016 election, whereas the Georgia case and the DC case are about the 2020 election. So in my view, we really have kind of three cases dealing with election interference. But I think previously you had mentioned you thought that was the case that might start first, and you were planning on being in the courtroom. Is there something that you want to highlight about that case as we close our discussion for people who are listening, where you think, I think we basically know the allegations, we know the players, but as a journalist and as a presidential historian, were you really hoping to highlight one element that you think maybe hasn't gotten enough attention yet?
Well, you know, the difference between the federal case that Jack Smith is bringing in Washington and the Georgia case is that the federal case is more tightly focused on Trump. And also, it is the federal judiciary saying that this was an assault on our democracy, an assault on our Constitution. And the issues at stake are, you know, more significant than paying off a porn star. So when that case, if that case eventually goes to trial, it will be the most significant criminal trial in American history, full stop. There's no other case that's even close. So in 1806, former Vice President Aaron Burr was put on trial for treason. He was acquitted. He was a vice president. Trump was a president. So the Jack Smith Trump coup trial, because they did try to stage a coup, that's what it was, is of surpassing importance as a historical event. Now, I think the hush money trial is also historic because it's the first time, as you said, a former president or a future president, a president of any kind has faced a criminal trial. So it's history making in itself, but the Jack Smith trial is a momentous moment, and I will be hugely disappointed if that case never goes to trial, so that we could get some basic constitutional accountability. And I think it's very, very important that he be convicted in that case to strengthen our democracy and to reinforce the guardrails that you mentioned.
Do you think there's any defense for the Supreme Court deciding to take the case?
Yeah, I think it's understandable why they took the case, because while the Supreme Court has ruled in whether a former president can be tried in civil court in the Nixon versus Fitzgerald case, they've never ruled about whether a former president can be tried criminally. And so you can understand why they would want to weigh in on it. But I think that they've been very irresponsible in not accelerating the pace of this case the way they did with the Nixon tapes case, the way they did with Bush versus Gore in late 2000. And so it's as if there's a feeling on part of the court, we don't know how much of it, that they want to go with Trump's strategy of running out the clock, which would be really, really unfortunate.
And as you mentioned, I mean, this is the type of case that I will teach. I teach Nixon versus Fitzgerald. I teach U.S. versus Nixon. I teach Clinton versus Jones. I teach all of the cases dealing with presidential immunity and executive privilege, and they're all Supreme Court cases. So it makes sense the court wants to weigh in. And of course, the court is going to weigh in on another case, not dealing with a former president, but dealing with somebody else involved in January 6th, and we'll be tackling whether or not the obstruction statute that accounts for half of the charges in this Jack Smith case that we've been talking about, whether or not that's a good fit. So I have to admit that I'm also of the mind that we're basically waiting on that case anyway.
Yeah, that's a super interesting point. I mean, people say, well, you know, of the four counts, that if the court goes against the plaintiffs in or against the government in the obstruction case, that would slice the number of counts in half. But the two other counts, which are basically related to the fake electors scheme, are still very powerful. So I think it would be too bad if the obstruction parts of the case were severed, but not fatal to that case. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, you could easily continue. I mean, arguably, you could also easily continue before the immunity decision comes out. And you could say, just proceeding on things that are clearly not official acts. Thanks so much. And let's go. Because as we know, the immunity question deals with qualified or absolute immunity for official acts. I think there was a way to potentially sever that case, but that's obviously not where we are at this point.
Well, so, but here's the big danger, and this is what I'm really worried about, because if everybody's assuming that, you know, the court hears the arguments in late April, and then, you know, maybe in late May or early June, they render a decision, and then that still leaves time to have a trial that starts in September, which, you know, could be pretty interesting, even if there's not going to be a verdict before the election. You could have people going to the polls when Trump is on trial for trying to overturn an election. It's not a good look for a presidential candidate. But the reason that I'm quite worried that that won't happen is that I think it's quite possible that the opinion that the Supreme Court renders says, look, you have to take all of these charges back and determine in a lower court whether beyond the outer perimeter of his official duties. In other words, was that call in Georgia, was that, you know, part of his official duties as chief law enforcement officer of the United States, you know, assigned by the Constitution to take care that the laws are faithfully executed? Was he just calling Brad Raffensperger to make sure that he was faithfully executing, you know, voting laws? That's what Trump will argue, you know. And if all of that has to be litigated, what was inside the outer perimeter, what was outside, then you're going to have more delay. And I fear that that's what's going to happen.
I talked about that on a recent, in a recent column where I said, this is going to be a ruling, I think, that sends it back to the lower court, not okay, and now go ahead, but okay, and now here's a new standard, and you need to apply that standard, and you need to determine what's official, what's not. And I think we're going to see something that uses the words qualified immunity, not absolute or not complete lack of immunity, that we're going to see some sort of middle ground, and Judge Chutkan will have some work before this trial begins. So, well, that was my conversation with Jonathan Alter. I had a great time talking to him. The conversation continued for a while. We had to edit for length, and I hope you enjoyed hearing everything that we had to talk about.